Enough. Is there any time that you'd like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
And counsel, you may begin whenever you wish.
Thank you. Your Honors, and may it please the court, I'm James Martin from Martin & Martin Law Firm, representing Alonzo Troy Roan in this case, which is a termination of parental rights from Halifax Circuit Court. I was not involved in it all the way through. It's a pretty lengthy and convoluted case, at least the related cases to it. I don't think there's previous counsel, and he had waived at one point on counsel. There may be other counsel in the foster care proceedings, but I don't think there's a prior counsel in the termination of rights proceedings. We are submitting on behalf of Mr. Roan, that although this is a very difficult case for everyone, including social services, we certainly acknowledge that. It's one that a sibling of the child in question was murdered by someone else, and but we assert that Mr. Roan, and there's two Alonzo Roans, the dead child was also called Alonzo Roan Jr., but my client, Mr. Roan, I would respectfully submit as being blamed indirectly for the sins of others. He's not being accused of murder, but there is a part of this case where the trial judge felt that since a juvenile court order had ordered him to, he did not appeal this order, and it said the parents had been basically neglectful by putting him in the custody of this person who later turned out to be even worse than they thought and a murderer. The reason the child went to them is, you know, social services in various counties. It was partly Halifax,
Mr. Martin, let me stop you. Where does that put us if that order was not appealed in terms of the determination of abuse neglect?
Well, I mean, the trial judge felt that because of the S on parent that, you know, that was a finding that Mr. Roan had been somehow neglectful. I think where it puts the court is that the court has to consider all the evidence and see if a reasonable trier of fact could think that there was clear and convincing evidence. My position is that the evidence is inherently and legally insufficient because the evidence indicates, and I believe it's unrebutted, that the reason the child ended up there is not only because social services countenanced it at one point in one of the counties, but also because Mr. Roan's the mother of the child, the mother of the child, actually left him and took Avelina, the child in question, and the child that was later murdered with her. So, I understand that he did not appeal that order. He did not have counsel at that time. But I don't think that it's clear enough just because you have the S on the end of parent that, you know, that can be relied on in another proceeding where counsel is on his behalf challenging this and challenging not just the sufficiency of the evidence but the legal sufficiency as well. I don't think that precludes the court from ruling that that this case should be reversed. There's no question that Mr. Roan is not a murderer. There's no question that he was not aiding and abetting that. There's no question that he never abused the child.
What about his actions more accurately, his inactions once the child is in foster care and there's a plan for return home to him?
Well, I think that's really all they have is, you know, at one point he was not completely active, or at least there were communication problems between himself and social services. A part of this was in Halifax County. Part of it was in Mecklenburg County. He lived in Florida. So if we're going to say that because you live in Florida, because you don't care enough about your child to move to Virginia.
But it wasn't he didn't move back to Virginia. To follow up on Judge O'Brien's question, wasn't it that he was making no attempt, significant attempt, to contact the child during that time period?
Well, I think there was a time period in which both he and social services, frankly, were derelict in their need to contact each other. There were workers who were changed on this. He testified that he had tried to get a hold of one worker and, you know, had not had his calls returned. There's no question that some of this was due to Mr. Roan, but he did step up to the plate at one point, got his psychological.
But that was actually right before the last hearing.
That was right before the last hearing in the juvenile court, which was later appealed to.
Let me follow up on the questions that both Judges O'Brien and Beals just asked you in terms of his involvement or lack of involvement. The court, the circuit court in this matter, did go through that and discuss his lack of involvement and the things that he was required to do in terms of keeping in contact with the child. Is there any reason that there wouldn't be evidence in the record to support that termination would be proper under C1 rather than the C2 and the B?
Well, we submit that there's not evidence to do it under either one, Your Honor. I mean, there has been some lack of contact at a certain point, but as I say, he stepped up to the plate. He got the psychological. They didn't like it because it was not as lengthy as they thought. And social services, I just would respectfully say, they accepted everything that this so-called therapist said about the danger to the child in, you know, having a change in her situation after this murder, which she witnessed, which of course the child is going to be traumatized, but this was just a licensed professional counselor. It wasn't a psychiatrist or psychologist. I submit that it's insufficient under both sections. They just accepted what this counselor said. And even if what she said was correct, he did step up to the plate and try to start doing it, got the psychological, and he had initiated some contact with her. It wasn't in-person contact at that point.
It was through the foster mother, and there was conversations that the foster mother had about the contact and content of that contact and whether that was appropriate. I think it was...
Well,
I don't know,
there
it would
were
be obscene,
some,
but I guess it was just rap lyrics that he sent to her.
Well, there were some, you know, controversies over that, which I'm sure that the, you know, the county or social services well has certainly pointed out, and it's in my brief as well. You know, there are two sides to. The only thing I know that they said was inappropriate was this film. She said that he was not aware of everything on it, and he said, you should give this to the child. Apparently, it was not actually given to the child, I don't think. And, you know, certainly, any way you look at that, that was not a good parental decision. But in the grand scheme of things where the government, frankly, is trying to take your child, I mean, you know, look around the mall, look at cars going down the road and what people say in front of their children at wedding receptions and the music that's played. And, I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and it still doesn't seem like, is this really going on that people talk this way or have so-called music this way in front of their child? So, yes, there is there some evidence to that? Yes, there is some evidence to that, but we would just submit that no reasonable trier of fact could say that that was clear and convincing evidence. There is a strong presumption in favor of the birth parent. The mother has not appealed her termination, so it makes it extra difficult for him, plus the fact that he lives in Florida makes it extra difficult for him. But the other mistake that social services made was that they clearly, in addition to believing anything that a counselor says, they believe that once you have a de novo appeal that there is no contact and no services can be provided, and they explicitly agreed to that in the cross-examination that I did of them, that once they had a juvenile court decision in the favor of social services, he would call up and they wouldn't do anything. So why do we have de novo appeals to circuit court, much less appeals to your honors, if social services is going to have a standard like that. So we would just submit that, you know, that he's not guilty under either subsection, guilty, if you will. I mean, he's not proven to be basically an unfit parent under either subsection. And we would just ask the court to dismiss this termination.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I think I neglected to ask whether you were going to, I'm sorry, Ms. Burns, whether you were going to split your time with the guardian and whether she wanted to be.
It is my intention involved. To retain just a few minutes for the guardian line to speak on the guardian best interest of the child. So.
All right, and how much time did you want to give to the guardian?
5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Matthew Evans on behalf of Halifax County Department of Social Services. This appeal is the termination of parental rights under two separate sections of 16.1283. Father's arguments primarily go to that first prong, which is when the child has been abused and neglected, and the court looks at the situations that led to that abuse or neglect and whether those situations...
Well, let me jump in. How is there evidence or proof that father in this particular case was the cause of the abuse or neglect?
So I think the trial court talked about that specifically, and counsel argued regarding the language of the adjudicatory order that was not appealed. The trial court's decision the trial court's opinion set forth that it was father's non-involvement with the child that led to essentially neglect. He did not provide a place for the child to go to in this scenario, that it was his lack of involvement, his lack of contact for 18 months prior to DSS removing the child. That created that situation.
But is it neglectful to have a child placed in another home if you're not aware of any issues?
So, possibly not. The father testified that he was aware that there were some issues and that he just didn't want to deal with the stepfather, and it was that stepfather's involvement that eventually led to the stepfather's family that eventually led to the other child being murdered. But I don't think, Your Honors, that we even necessarily have to get to that argument because we have that second prong of C2, 16.1283 C2. I think that the court's rationale is reasonable as it relates to B, 16.1283 B, and that there's no need to overturn that decision under B, but we also have that second prong of C2 that's before the court that specifically refers to what dad has done, and it's affirmative as to what the parent has done to remedy the continuation of the foster care placement.
So you're talking about once he knew where the child was and his lack of contact at that point under C2 is what you're talking about now. Is that right?
I'm referring to specifically after the child came into care. Mm-hmm. Father was at one of the initial removal hearings. He attended the adjudicatory hearing as well as the dispositional hearing where the court specifically did not place custody with him. And that dispositional order, final order, was not appealed. A plan was put in place to provide a path for him to receive that child into his home. What he did from that point forward, we have an initial 4 month period between that 60 day dispositional hearing and the initial foster care review hearing, the 4 month hearing. The record is clear, and Dad testified he did absolutely nothing. That's confirmed in the foster care review order. The plan is incorporated into that foster care review order. It says Dad had no contact with anybody. Interestingly enough, the dispositional order that's in the record specifically provides Dad the ability to have contact with the child under supervision of a therapist, and that was not even exercised during that first 4 months period.
So you totally disagree with what your opposing counsel just said as far as that DSS essentially doesn't make the child available to him.
No, it's specifically in the order. The court order specifically provides a therapeutic setting for contact in that first 4 month period. After that first foster care review hearing, dad does eventually sit down with the therapist. You then have the next 6 months, which puts us to that 1 year mark, where the court has to look at, okay, within that first 12 months, what has happened? We have, for all intents and purposes, threshold services that are being provided. Okay, let's look at your home and establish what needs to be done there. We got an ICPC referral application done. We get a home study back. Father's home looks okay, but in those next 6 months, father moves 3 times on his testimony. The paramour that was his support system in the home that was approved is both financially and would support the child being there is gone. He's now with somebody else. And none of this was reported to the Department of Social Services. And the Department of Social Services had no idea how to contact him. Contact letters were being sent out and returned to the department. Also within that, coming up on that 12-month time frame, this is February of 2017, you have the therapist that's met back in September saying, I am here, we're going to create a plan, give me a photograph of you, which he doesn't provide for over a month, so I can start the process of reunification to reunite you with this child. He makes no contact with the therapist after those initial contacts. There's a psychological that's recommended, psychological evaluation that's recommended by the Department of Social Services and the therapist. It's scheduled, and father cancels it with no good cause. And that's one of the biggest things, is there's no good cause for why he hasn't made contact with social services, why he hasn't made contact with the therapist that is specifically there to provide the services that are essential for this man to be reunified with his child.
Is there any significance to the fact that the department terminated services after the juvenile court order while this matter was on appeal to the circuit court?
So I don't know that that's even accurate. The testimony that was given by the workers themselves were they still received no contact from him. That the number that he had, it was shown by counsel to the worker, what's this number? And the worker said, that's my number. Have you received calls? No. And then on cross-examination, if you would have received calls, this is the testimony starts on 134 of the appendix, but if you had received calls, could you have talked to him about what needed to happen? Absolutely. That could have been done. And so the testimony is unrebutted. Well, not unrebutted. Father does testify that he did call and didn't get anybody. But the workers testify that he did not even contact them after the de novo appeal before the trial court hearing. The difficulty for the department is, in order to really provide the services that are needed for a child that has special needs, in order to act in the child's best interest, what the guardian ad litem will hopefully address a little bit more in a second, we have to be able to assess. That is why you do a home study. That's why you look at what the conditions of the home are. It was moot. After at a year's time, we had nothing about where dad was. We had nothing about his home situation, his finances, which were the implication was he was not financially stable because his paramour was, according to the home study, was his financial support. We had no idea about other people that were in the home. We do have a history of CPS and recommendations from previous CPS contact of intensive in-home services. We don't even know where he is, and he's not responding to us at that 12-month mark. We don't have a recommendation of additional services from the psychological evaluation that could really give some very specific and probably very vital recommendations as to this child and this father and how we can move things together. The ideal would be that father, and the trial court said this, father needed to be there early and there often. And his own testimony, I didn't do a thing in between hearings. I didn't contact anybody. I just waited until the next hearing to see what they wanted me to do. The court pointed out in Mr. Martin's argument, the possible application of C1. The district court actually ruled the termination under C1. There is some difficulty in a medical professional recommending that contact not happen, but we couldn't even get to that point. We could not. There was barriers to the department even getting to the point where we could make recommendations and augment contact and provide visitation, because Dad did not even respond to any of the initial services that were taking place. And the ones that were provided, the home study, if it can be called a service, was rendered moot by his inattentiveness.
By his what? Sorry.
By his inattentiveness.
I thought you were going to say because he moved and that home study wasn't.
Yeah. And well, if we had known that he was going to move, we could have adjusted that. If he had updated us, we possibly could have gotten something else done or had somebody do a drop by and look at that, but we did not, had no idea. Even we could not remedy the delays that were completely on him and without good cause created the situation where at the time of the trial court hearing, we were 2 years into a foster care placement with no foreseeable timeline as to when father would be able to get back with this child.
Mr. Evans, you're into the time that you said that you wanted
Trent
to be able to, but it seems like she's happy to...
Just briefly, if I may.
Defer it to you.
It is sufficient for the court to rule under one of the prongs. The trial court properly looked at a lengthy list of the facts that are, for all intents and purposes, unrebutted as to Dad's delays to the services or barriers to services being put into place. And on appeal, there just hasn't been anything showing that those rulings were clearly wrong or without basis. And the department would ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you, Mr.
This room is a little like a Las Vegas casino, so I'm not sure if it's morning or afternoon yet, so good day, Your Honors. My name is Elizabeth Blair Trent, and I'm the guardian ad litem for AR in this appeal. My main point and my main job is to point out that the best interests of the child in this case, which is very clearly laid out by the trial court, and actually counsel for the appellant even, albeit flippantly, concedes that the best interest of the child is very clearly met, that the termination was appropriate. The record and the court findings were that appellant should have, and co-counsel accurately described this, should have engaged in this child's life and just did not. He did have significant hurdles to becoming a part of this child's life because of the trauma, which was no fault of his own. But he did not do the things that were needed. Those were not insurmountable obstacles for him. They were just hurdles that he needed to go through. And there, actually, the record shows that he sat down in my office and I explained that those were going to be significant hurdles to this father. And there was almost a defeatist attitude throughout this proceeding from the beginning of the lower court all the way through the trial court. And I'd even
do you attribute
here.
Any of that to his being in Florida, living in Florida, or is it? Were there plenty of other opportunities for him to be in contact with the child, if not in person?
There were not, I would state, with what technology we have in today's modern world. He stated in his own testimony that he had had FaceTime and phone contact with the child between July 31st, 2014, when the child left, and when the child was taken into care. And he had contact with the foster care parents. He had contact with the therapist. That's all in the record. That he could have gone that length. We live in a much smaller world now with technology linking us. He could have done those things, and he just did not, Judge. The other thing I want to really stress upon this court is laid out in the record that the child here, who is 7, was 4 at the time that her brother was murdered in front of her, is able to vocalize her instability and her acknowledgement and consciousness of the lack of permanence that she has. And I would suggest to the court that I'm not sure what the remedy is here, even if the court were to overturn the TPR, because what is unappealed in the lower court is the foster care plan goal that there should be a recommendation for termination and adoption. That is unappealed. So what remedy, even if the court were to overturn it here and send it back to the trial court, what is the remedy? We still have an unappealed order of termination, and all this is going to do is prolong this 7-year-old child who is not able to hear from her foster care parents that she is safe, that they can accurately tell her now that she's not going anywhere. And the record is very clear that she is afraid of that, and that stress antagonizes the really horrific trauma and PTSD that she has based on the horrific things that were brought to this child, which were not the fault of the appellant, but that were not fixed by him, and he did not step in to try and save her despite knowing where she was. So, Judge, I implore you on behalf of this child, please affirm the lower court's decision. Please state that this child can have the permanence that she needs in her life.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Trent. Mr. Martin?
Yes, Your Honors. We did not, as we pointed out in our reply brief, we did not concede that the best interest of the child would mandate this decision. We pointed out, you know, assuming arguendo, basically, that it was in the best interest of the child, there's a whole lot of other stuff in the statute. I mean, it's a very convoluted statute. I tried to break it down on page 25 of my brief, and then under C on page 27. But we have social services and the guardian ad litem, with all due respect, talking about the best interest of the child as if that was the be-all and end-all of this statute. It would be a very short statute. It would be about the size of the murder statute, which is maybe, 20 or 30 words. It wouldn't be the convoluted statute that it is if the best interest of the child was the only thing. And the best interest of the child is related to the other things in the statute, because most people think that the best interest of the child, and the legal presumption upholds this, that it's best for them to be with their natural parents if that is possible. Otherwise, if, as I pointed out in the brief, I mean, if Bill Gates wanted to adopt her, then you could have a pretty good argument that it's in the best interest of the child because he can give her all this stuff and he's not an abuser and he's not a neglector and so forth and so on. My client is not an abuser. My client is not a neglector of a child, except in the sense of being a neglector to get back to social services and do the things promptly that they are demanding that he do because of this counselor. And not saying that those are bad things to be done, but, I mean, are you going to lose your child because you don't do them as soon as you should? That's what we're complaining about on this. That social services had, fallen short even from the beginning on page 7 of my brief, that, you know, at the beginning of this thing, after the murder, why didn't they place the child with my client, at least when they found out where he was. And, there was a home study in Florida that deemed him to be suitable. Now, I know he moved to another part of Florida, but any concerns and hoops that he has to jump through, I mean, all we have is contact itself. The contact is for the purpose of remedying the situation. But what situation needed to be remedied? When you're not an abuser and you're not a neglector, he has a job. He says he can pay for another home study. I think he has 3 jobs. He has other children. I think most of them don't live with him. I would submit that when you have a fit parent who is not an abuser and not a neglector, that's very, of course, very important in the case. There was an unfounded complaint in Florida, point out on page 9 of the brief, that, you know, other than supposedly putting this child in harm's way, which I submit he didn't, the only thing he's failed to do is contact expeditiously, which I think he remedied. I look for this in the appendix. I don't think I can remedy this in the next 44 seconds, but I don't think that there was absolutely no contact by him after September 17th, 2017. He was certainly in contact with this foster mother, and I can't absolutely say when that contact was, but I don't think it's true that there was no contact and we're just having a hypothetical thing about contact here. He has done some contact, and we would just submit that no reasonable trier of fact could rule that there's clear and convincing evidence that the presumption of the parental rights not being terminated, that it should be done. Thank you.
Thank you.